It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Welcome to our Friday handful of quick conversations about news we didn't get to otherwise during the week. Later in the program, we'll have a couple of ag-related stories. This one out of Mexico. Is Mexico ready to say no to U.S. corn exports, Iowa corn exports? How farm groups are worried about new immigration enforcement. We'll look back 75 years to a presidential executive order that interned in camps Japanese Americans and ask, does its legal footing compare with today's travel ban? Also, a new study suggesting flag football isn't safer than tackle football. And that big question I'll put to climatologist Elwin Taylor of ISU, what is going on with our weather? Not that we're complaining. It's a beautiful weekend that Dennis just forecast for us. Yesterday, after 3 days of bitter partisan debate, the Iowa House and Senate gave final approval to a bill critics say will decimate Iowa's collective bargaining law. It's a law that covers 180,000 public employees here in the state. Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent Joyce Russell joins me now. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
So tell us, what are the changes to this, I guess I have to say, soon-to-be-new law?
Well, it drastically scales back, as some would say, gut Iowa's collective bargaining law passed by and signed into law by Governor Ray back in 1974. You can look at this two ways. One piece of this really drastically alters what happens at the bargaining table, takes a whole long line of things that union workers bargain for, all kinds of working conditions, seniority, grievance, supplemental pay, all of those things. None of those are mandatory bargaining terms anymore. So the only thing that local governments and school districts have to bargain over are wages, and there are caps on those. Mm-hmm. So the whole bargaining situation is going to look very different. And then the other pieces of this, which these are the parts that they actually call the union busting, the unions will no longer be able to have their dues deducted from their paycheck, which is a big boon to unions in their organizing and their business relations. They will have to use their own resources to go after their members and collect the dues. So that's one thing. And then there's going to be something called a mandatory recertification vote. So once unions are a union, they pretty much stay a union. And under this bill, ahead of every bargaining session, every bargaining term, they will have to recertify, and they'll have to do it at their own expense. So they will have to do another vote in order to, like, starting from scratch, to be the union that represents these teachers in this town. So those are just really, really big things against the unions.
Fierce opposition we heard in the State House, your reporting, among others, Joyce, from Democrats, from labor unions. What is the GOP arguing for in this case? We have to say the vote was, I understand, mostly along party lines, but not entirely, right?
That's right. What is the GOP arguing for? Well, yep. The arguments that they put forward is that local governments can better manage their workforces to, you will hear them say, to get rid of bad teachers, make it easier to get rid of bad teachers and bad employers. But, I mean, employees, not just teachers, but other employees. But, make no mistake about it. This is just a strike against the unions. And it's going to be very hard for them to, I think it's going to be very hard for them to bounce back. They will tell you, they had a news conference after the vote, and Tammy Warrow in particular is a very prominent figure in this debate. She's the president of the Iowa State Education Association, a very well-spoken and dynamic woman. And she said, this has energized us. This has energized teachers. So she's not taking it as a death blow, but there's no doubt about it. It's a real blow against the unions.
Tell us a couple of the scenes that stand out from you from this tumult in the State House this week. Probably not like anything you've seen in your years covering the State House.
Well, there were very big crowds. You have to go through security at the State House, and the number on Monday, the number of people that went through security, which is a pretty good gauge of how many people have come into the building. And not everybody even got into the building, but 4,500 people went through security on that Monday. On a typical Monday, you have about 800 people coming through security. So it was really big crowds. It was interesting because we had such big crowds this year also on the Planned Parenthood bill. But that was big. Those crowds were big because there were a whole bunch of people on both sides. You had all of the Planned Parenthood supporters, but you also had the Right to Life people. So that created, you know, big crowds on both sides. This was, you know, this was really all unions. The business groups, the Americans for Prosperity, that's the Koch brothers group, Iowans for Tax Relief. There was another group that was corporate sponsored that ran ads on TV. I didn't happen to see any of these ads, but they were ads in favoring this bill. They, you know, they had a few people there, but you know, it was primarily all the calls were, you know, 99-to-1 calls into the switchboard and all of that.
Well, Joyce, we've got a couple minutes left, so to finish up with that bill, it will be signed very soon by the governor. The governor's made no qualms about signing it, right? He's fully in favor of it.
The day that the bill was introduced, he had a news conference flanked by the Republican leaders, so it was clear that these folks are all on the same page.
So as soon as when does it become law?
Oh, well, I talked to the governor's spokesman this morning. There was talk yesterday he was going to sign it today and then it was all going to be done. Mm-hmm. But the governor's spokesman said he's reviewing the bill, as he always is. It's a very big bill, reviewing the bill. But as soon as it goes into effect, then these contract negotiations with the unions are going to be drastically affected, sort of midstream. There were a lot of a number of teachers' contracts that schools rushed through this week, held, you know, special meetings, getting the rush through this week so that they would not be affected by the new law. The Democrats tried to delay implementation to avoid that kind of, you know, interruption of contract negotiations that are underway.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Planned Parenthood. Give us an update on that. It's a bill that blocks public funding to Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers. It advanced this week, right?
Yeah, that has already passed the Senate, and that was a long debate a couple of weeks back. And this week, it had its first hearing, a subcommittee meeting in the House. That happened on the same day that the labor union public hearing was held. They didn't have the big crowds there. They might have thought, oh my gosh, there's going to be so many people there for this other public hearing. I'm not sure why the public didn't bring both sides out for this hearing. But anyway, that's kind of a greased wheel that's going to go before the committee and then before the full House. And Governor Branstad is expected to sign that too.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, an update on the minimum wage. Republican lawmakers pushing a bill that would freeze Iowa's minimum wage at $7.25. Here, they're going against their idea of local control, stripping local counties and cities of the ability to set their own wage limits, other limitations. What's an update on that?
Well, yeah, everybody expected this bill that would say to the counties and cities, I guess it's been counties and with some, I guess, difference the way the cities have adopted it. But anyway, everybody expected the bill to deal with this problem because it is kind of a problem that some local governments have a different minimum wage, although I think businesses are overstating that problem. But at any rate, everybody expected some kind of bill to deal with this. There were some hints before the session. There was some sentiment being expressed in the Senate anyway to grandfather in these counties that already have done that. But what the bill that came advanced in the House would not only say that these counties can't that they'll have to just rescind their higher minimum wage and throw those out, but it also extended it to some other local control issues. For example, that local governments cannot pass civil rights legislation that is stronger than state law, or cities can't say, okay, in the grocery stores you can't use plastic bags.
Mm-hmm.
Can't do that anymore under this bill. It's okay. Just really, really wide ranging, and I think it took people by surprise. And I'm not sure what the fate of that is going to be.
Okay, all for now. Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent. Busy week. Wish you especially a nice weekend to relax a little bit before what will undoubtedly be another busy week at the State House.
Right.
Joyce, thank you.
Okay, thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, here's some news that came from outside the U.S. that caught our eye that may impact Iowa. News this week that Mexico may be ready to hit the U.S. where it hurts, and where Iowa, especially where it hurts, namely in corn exports. Mexico is one of the top buyers of American corn, and of course, Iowa, one of the top corn-producing states. And in response to Donald Trump's threats against Mexico, a Mexican senator who leads a congressional committee on foreign relations said this week he would introduce a bill that directs Mexico to buy its corn from Brazil and Argentina instead of the United States. Here to pick this apart a little bit, Dave Swenson, associate scientist at Iowa State University's Department of Economics and College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. Dave, always good to have you on to interpret something like this. Nice to have you step into our studio.
Well, thank you.
First of all, how much? Give us a magnitude here. Mexico is Iowa's top corn export market. How much corn are we talking?
Well, the volume of corn is a little bit hard to figure out. What we need to pay attention to is that Iowa's number two total export market is Mexico, and agriculture products play a large role in that market. So the corn is we are very, very efficient at moving corn down the Mississippi River, down to the Gulf Terminals, from the Gulf Terminals over to Mexico. And so it's a very, very nice and easy straight shot of moving corn into the Mexican markets. And so it very much affects Iowa, and it very much affects Illinois primarily, any kind of threat to those exports. But let's back up just a little bit here. You had rhetoric that began early on in this administration with regard to building the border wall and how we might fund it, and some misunderstanding. And what we ended up with was language and accusations and a little bit of cantankerousness on both sides with regard to our current trade relationships. The Mexican senator is again offering up this proposal to try to get Mexico to buy Argentinian and Brazilian corn. But we already have an operating North American Free Trade Agreement. There are no duties or tariffs with regard to the flow of agricultural goods in both directions. Users of corn in Mexico are going to seek the lowest price, and that's going to probably be reflected in the proximity to the largest supplier in the world, and that's the United States. Indirectly, it's Iowa, especially Illinois as well. And so right now we're at the talking stage. There's somebody trying to shoot a shot across the bow of the trade talk. And this is what happens when you threaten basically to have trade border wars. And this is one of the consequences. The United States now, again, it's moved back. The language, the rhetoric early on has moved back. There's something called a border adjustment tax, which isn't a tariff or a tax on Mexico, per se. And a lot of people don't know what's going on or don't understand either trade policy, or they don't understand NAFTA, or they don't understand tax policy that's being promoted.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit more, because this president is not a friend of NAFTA. He said he would plan to renegotiate it or scrap it. NAFTA, we go back, signed, I see, in 1993 under President Clinton. It has changed our economy, has reshaped. We've lost jobs, but we've gained some other things there, too. So NAFTA, I don't know, is there a big picture way of looking at the impact of NAFTA on our economy and our ag economy especially?
Well, on the ag economy, NAFTA specifically is beneficial to United States agricultural commodity production. Eliminated tariffs on commodities, corn, soybeans, eventually wheat. And so you had the flow, you had an opportunity for greater sales from the United States, greater exports down into Mexico. As a matter of fact, many people in Mexico will say that the exports were so successful in terms of corn and soybeans, but especially corn, that it actually ended up being disruptive to the Mexican agricultural economy. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, though, that flow of goods to Mexico was relatively robust. Mexico also benefited, the United States benefited from exports of machinery, construction, agricultural, that kind of machinery, again, down to Mexico. What we got in return primarily was an increased access to manufactured goods from Mexico that were automobiles, electrical machinery, and electrical appliances, those types of things. And so the net effect of this, as many people have argued, is that we lost a lot of manufacturing jobs to lower wage manufacturing labor costs in Mexico. And so it had that offset. But it increased the opportunity for sales from other kinds of producers in the United States, to include suppliers of the automobile industry, to the Mexican markets. Mm-hmm. Some economists will argue that it's been a net gain. Other economists will argue that it's been a drag, and especially on the manufacturing sector.
Okay, Dave Swenson, that's all the time we have now, but I'm sure we'll be in touch again to see if this heated rhetoric between the United States and Mexico is followed by actions, and we'll see. Dave Swenson of Iowa State University, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, also related to what we just talked about this week, we heard a report by Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon about, well, after hundreds of arrests of undocumented immigrants by immigration police in this country, the Trump administration's increased focus on immigration enforcement has some of the country's largest farm groups worried. Joining me now by phone from Colorado, Luke Runyon, agribusiness reporter with Harvest Public Media, based out of KUNC. Hi, Luke.
Hi.
From northern Colorado. Tell us, first of all, how much of our workforce is made of undocumented immigrants, and how many work in agriculture?
Yeah, so if you look at the number of undocumented immigrants in agriculture, it makes up actually a pretty significant portion. There was a report just last year from the Pew Research Center that showed undocumented workers are in about 26% of the nation's farm jobs, so just about a quarter. And it was actually the highest percentage among all occupations that Pew looked at in that study. So a lot of reliance in agriculture on undocumented workers.
Okay, and we have I'm just reading right off my screen right now. This is an update on it. This is from USA Today, a headline. DHS memo proposes using up to 100,000 guard troops to round up immigrants. So this is putting even more pressure on here. You were talking with ag leaders about the, even before that headline, about the worries from ag business leaders. What are their concerns?
Well, a crackdown on immigrant workers could really put a lot of farms at risk, and at least a few agricultural trade groups are starting to take precautions already and communicating to some of their farmer members about what could happen. And it's important to note here that these aren't just the ag groups that you'd normally expect to be vocal on some of these issues, like the National Farmers Union, which tends to be a little bit more liberal or progressive in its membership. These are big farm groups that tend to be a little bit more conservative. So I talked to Jackie Klippenstein. She's an executive with Dairy Farmers of America. They're a co-op with about 14,000 dairy farmers in their membership. And she says that they're starting to tell members to be on the lookout for increased immigration enforcement.
I think it's fair to say that everyone in agriculture is nervous and on edge. I think that there's already a labor shortage in agriculture and dairy specifically. This increased enforcement activity is causing great pause, because where will we go to harvest the food, in our case, the milk that's required to be harvested twice a day?
Mm. Luke, when you hear that, is the reaction going to matter? Are there levers of power that can be pressed by the ag industry leaders?
I think so. I mean, you saw a lot of rural support pop up for President Donald Trump during the 2016 election. And once you start to see some increased immigration enforcement, and it really puts a lot of farmers in a tight spot when it comes to labor. I mean, I visit a lot of farms, especially dairy farms, and they're already tight on labor. They have a really hard time hiring workers. And so if you make that labor pool even smaller, you're putting those dairy farms at real risk of potentially shutting down or having to limit their operations. And once you start talking about threatening someone's livelihood or their business, I think you're going to start to see a lot more frustration from the farming community.
Mm-hmm. Luke, this week we heard an interesting report you did when you profiled the town of Fort Morgan there in Colorado. That's a town I've been through many times on the way to Denver. a large immigrant population. This is really interesting because this is a county in which Fort Morgan is nearly 70% voted for Trump, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. It's a large immigrant population. We assume not a voting population.
Yeah, and Fort Morgan is actually kind of illustrative of a lot of towns throughout the Midwest and the Great Plains. You know, you have high concentrations of both documented and undocumented immigrants in communities that have meatpacking facilities, and Fort Morgan is one of those places. You know, you don't often need to know a lot of English or have a ton of skills to get a job in a meatpacking plant, and so these cities that have a meatpacking facility draw a lot of immigrant workers, and you end up with kind of a mix of cultures mm-hmm. in a really rural area. And just in Fort Morgan, you have a significant Somali population. It's already a town that is minority-majority, where you're looking at a town that has less than half of its population is white. The majority is Latino and African-American. So, yeah, you're starting to see a lot of these small rural communities diversifying really quickly. But not necessarily turning out for elections.
Right. And also you mentioned in your piece asking the question, are the election results you saw in that county represent a backlash? Has there been tension in this community that would cause nearly 70% to vote for a candidate who wants to change immigrant policies drastically?
Yeah, there's been some tension, as you would expect. The East African population in Fort Morgan first started showing up about 10 years ago. And when they first started arriving in town, there was definite tension. There were a few acts of vandalism at apartment complexes where Somali refugees were living. There just recently was a religious dispute at the meatpacking plant in town where about 200 Muslim workers were fired for walking out after a dispute over prayer mm-hmm. breaks in the yeah. meatpacking plant.
Luke, we have just a few seconds left. What can we look forward to you covering in the future on this area?
Yeah, we're focused a lot on this idea of the rural-urban divide. It was something that came out of the 2016 election as a way to explain a little bit about the election outcome. And so we're really going to be focused at Harvest Public Media on exploring that divide and talking more to rural people about what they care about.
Okay. Always appreciate your reporting and this conversation. Luke Runyon, agribusiness reporter with Harvest Public Media, based in northern Colorado. Thanks again, Luke.
Thanks.
Coming up in just a moment, when our news buzz continues, a look back 75 years to a presidential executive order that put Japanese Americans in internment camps. And we ask the question, what does it have today in terms of the legal footing with today's travel ban? That coming up, it's your news buzz. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in a second. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This morning on Morning Edition, perhaps you heard it on StoryCorps, we heard from two Japanese Americans and their memories as children being sent with their families to internment camps during the Second World War. Now, Sunday marks the 75th anniversary of the executive order that allowed that. The executive order by President Roosevelt that allowed Japanese Americans to be sent to these internment camps. It's also connected with a very famous U.S. Supreme Court decision that came down in 1944. Joining us to give us a little historical context and to make any comparisons that are needed to today's situation with the travel ban by President Trump, Mark Kendi is with us, director of the Constitutional Law Center at Drake University. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. You recently wrote an op-ed on this topic for the Des Moines Register. First of all, set the scene. Before we have you comment on any comparisons being made with Trump's travel ban, take us back. Set the scene. Tell us what prompted President Roosevelt to make this executive order in 1941.
I think the short answer is, you know, Pearl Harbor had taken place, and there was a concern about a column of potentially Japanese individuals invading on the West Coast, at least among some people, and created some fear both on the West Coast and in Washington, D.C. And, you know, a combination of these factors led the president to issue this kind of an order.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what were the details of the order? What was actually carried out?
The order allowed military commanders to make decisions regarding the location of and establish areas where people could be placed on the West Coast in case of the perception that there was a real danger. And then what subsequently happened was the military commanders did believe there was such a danger and then moved over 100,000 Japanese into these internment camps pursuant to that order.
Mm-hmm. And as we heard in the memory I referenced today on Morning Edition, the military just showed, the U.S. military showed up at the door, came in and said, you've got to throw as many things as you can in perhaps a pillowcase. They destroyed a shortwave radio in the case. But this was carried out with military efficiency.
Yes, this was not done in a soft way. This was a real, you know, sort of showing up at the door type thing with very little time to move and, you know, a real sense that the people they were dealing with might be dangerous. I think that's what was going on.
So, Mark, this is interesting. At this time, of course, we're at war with Germany and Italy, the other Axis powers, but no executive order against German Americans or Italian Americans.
Right. The executive order would have allowed military commanders to take potential actions against such groups, but the commander, in other words, it was a general executive order, but the commanders decided the real danger and the only danger was the Japanese, and I think they did so for reasons that have to do with racial bias.
Mm-hmm. How did the public react to this executive order at the time?
I think there were many in the public who were sympathetic, but the ACLU, I know, and some other groups obviously raised some concerns, although there was actually an interesting split within the ACLU because there were some people who thought that this was awful and there were others who were quite loyal to FDR. But generally, you know, I think there was some public approval of this among people who thought that, well, you know, why should we not believe what the military has to say?
Mm-hmm. This military incarceration of over 100,000 Americans of Japanese descent found its way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and a decision was handed down in 1944. A case, Korematsu versus the United States, this had to do with an individual named Fred Korematsu. Tell us, what is this story?
Yeah, he was just an ordinary, you know, individual, and you know, he'd worked in a variety of jobs. He'd experienced a whole bunch of discrimination and even lost some of the jobs because of discrimination towards him being Japanese. And then when this occurred, he was one of the people who resisted. And because he resisted going to the camp, he was arrested and charged.
So how did the Supreme Court decide, and what became of it after that?
Sure. Sure. So the case eventually worked its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and in a decision that we now think of as very bad, basically the court upheld, said it was okay to intern the Japanese, said it was okay to intern Mr. Korematsu, said that the dangers certainly were something that you had to defer to the president and the military in making the judgments on, and there were some powerful dissents written by justices. But the basic idea and basic premise was that at that time, we should trust the president and trust the military commanders in dealing with a wartime situation.
Mm-hmm. What was the follow-up in Fred Korematsu's situation? Compensation was at some point paid, wasn't it?
Yes, many years later, there was an apology issued, I believe, by Congress. Reparations of some type were paid to family members. Fred Korematsu led a very dignified life in which he spent much of his time going around the country talking about racism and talking about what happened to him. And I think he even received some sort of a medal from the president for his service to the country and sort of teaching us about the dangers of this kind of activity, mm-hmm. this kind of discrimination.
So, Mark, you wrote an op-ed piece on this topic for the Des Moines Register recently, the Fred Korematsu case, and connected it with the present. Tell us the points you wanted to make.
The basic connection is that Fred Korematsu continued to fight in this area and actually had a brief filed on behalf of Muslims who were being detained under the Bush administration. So you have this link between Fred Korematsu actually spending later time in his life helping the Muslims who are now being accused of being, people who are out to get us. And that's a link that, you know, one would never expect, because there's a long period of time between World War II and the present.
And then the similarities with the Trump travel ban?
The similarities are basically racial designation of people who are dangerous solely based on their status, whether it be Muslim in this case or Japanese in that case. And then you also have a connection with Fred Korematsu actually helping some of the Muslims who were accused under the Bush administration of having done something wrong.
Mm. So we don't know, or do we, whether Trump's travel ban will reach the Supreme Court. If it does, though, will this case be a precedent?
I believe it will be a precedent, but I think it's a slightly stronger case for the government in this situation. I mean, Korematsu right now has never been, the case itself has never been formally overturned, although his conviction has been vacated. But the case is still out there, and it's about presidential power. And so to the extent that when we get to an issue about can the government decide that people from these countries who are mostly Muslim can't come here, you bet the government's going to rely on a presidential power argument. They may not rely mainly on Korematsu, because that decision itself is not looked on with great regard, but they will certainly rely on the arguments made in Korematsu about presidential and military intelligence and power.
Mm-hmm. Mark Kendi, before we go, any predictions on how this will turn out if it goes to the Supreme Court?
You know, that's a really interesting question. I think part of the problem is a technical legal issue, which is who has standing to bring this lawsuit. Certainly the people who are in these foreign countries, they actually don't really easily have the ability to initiate litigation. They have no sort of right to come to the United States. But there are people who have visas. There are people who have, you know, permanent resident status, although some of them have been exempted. There may be a way to justify a lawsuit going forward. But I think, again, the concern about second-guessing the president is a tough one for the court. And although I'd like to see the court strike down this executive order, that might not happen. And I think the other thing to mention is that the government and President Trump has said he's going to issue a revised order, which if he issues a revised order, then that changes things, and then we'd have a whole different set of legal questions depending on what the new order says.
Mm-hmm. Mark Kendi, thank you very much for your insights. Director of the Constitutional Law Center at Drake University. We appreciate it, Mark.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a moment, what's going on with the weather? Climatologist Elwin Taylor will be with us. But first, goes along with beautiful weather, playing outside, playing ball. But what do you do if your kid wants to play football and you're worried about the injuries, especially the head trauma we've been hearing about in recent years? Is flag football the answer? A study released this week from the University of Iowa suggests that flag football isn't safer than tackle football among young athletes. Joining us, Dr. Andy Peterson, Clinical Associate Professor of Pediatrics, does a lot with sports medicine at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Peterson, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Did I get that right? Was there a typo, or did I not understand that? Flag football isn't safer than tackle football?
Yeah, it sure seems that way. We did a very large study, by far the largest study ever done on youth football injuries. It was just published this past weekend, and it turns out that the injury rates aren't substantially different between the two.
Mm-hmm. What about the type of injuries?
It does seem to be more severe injuries in tackle football. So there's more broken bones, more severely torn ligaments, things that would lead people to return to play more slowly. And in fact, we saw that the time to return to play after an injury was longer in the tackle football leagues. But one of those severe injuries, and the one that people seem to care the most about, wasn't any different, and that's concussion. So the rates of concussions were the same between the two types of football.
Mm. So let's think about that a minute, because, of course, flag football, and I want you to know, Dr. Peterson, you're talking with a member of an undefeated flag football team from the 1970s.
We all have our glory days.
Yes, Valley Park Cardinals. We never lost a game, but we wore no helmets. You know, you don't wear helmets, right? And so you've got one one setting, you're wearing helmets, you're crashing into each other, and the other setting, no helmets. So that's the difference, and you come out with roughly the same number of concussions.
Yeah, not just roughly, but pretty close to exactly the same number of concussions. You know, it's hard to know exactly why. I have a few guesses of my own, but we're starting to move a little bit away from the data when we start talking about our hypotheses about why this might be. My guess is that these concussions in flag football come in pairs, whereas in tackle football, they seem to be singular events, meaning in tackle football, someone hits hard or someone gets hit hard or they hit their head on the ground hard, that person gets concussed, and that's an event in and of itself. In the flag leagues, most of the concussions that we got seemed to come in twos, meaning anytime one concussion was reported, two concussions were reported. So I think it's mainly kids just running into each other accidentally and bumping heads hard.
So similar to what we see in soccer when two go up for a header on the ball.
Exactly. In fact, our rates of concussion here was pretty similar to what's seen in youth soccer.
Okay. So when we look at this study, and it sounds like you have more questions to answer based on the findings of this study.
Well, I think that the big broad point of this project was to better describe what the actual risks were in youth football. For a long time, people have been extrapolating from higher levels of football, what we know about high school and college football, to these younger kids. But without much data to support that, there really hadn't been any very well-done studies on youth football injury rates. And so we sought out to really provide good data so that people can make informed decisions based on real information, not information that's extrapolated from very different types of sport.
And Dr. Peterson, you deal with the Hawkeye football team, so you're dealing with bodies that are much larger, and we have greater physical forces. I mean, the group here you're dealing with, these are 60, 70, 80, 90-pound kids, right?
Yeah, if that, right? So this is grades 2 through 7, and there's some pretty small second graders out there. Yeah, that's absolutely right. The injuries that we see on Saturdays with the Hawkeyes and what you're seeing on television when you're watching professional or college football is very different than what's happening at the youth sport level. The collisions tend to be smaller amplitude. They don't happen as frequently. They're not playing as often. They're not practicing for as long. So their total exposure is less. The magnitude of the hits is less. So what you see on TV isn't like what's happening at the youth football leagues.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so a parent listening to this conversation may get confused and think, oh, well, tackle football, flag football, all the same. But that's not the message here?
Yeah, I think the take-home point here is that both are reasonably safe. I think we've been extrapolating from different levels of football for a long time and assuming that youth football was just as dangerous, and that's not really the case. The injury rates we're seeing in youth football are about a third to a quarter of what they are at the college level, and kids just don't seem to have very many injuries. The media spin on this all week has kind of been that flag football isn't any safer than tackle football, but I think it's really the opposite that's true. I think the take-home point is that both are pretty safe, and flag football is just as safe as tackle football.
Okay, interesting. Dr. Andy Peterson, where can we find this study? Is it online?
It is online. It's at the Orthopedic Journal of Sports Medicine. It's an open access journal, so anyone can download it.
Always good to hear about your fascinating studies. Dr. Andy Peterson with the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, thanks for coming into our studio.
Thanks again for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. As much as I love being in a windowless studio talking with you right now, I can't wait to finish up this workday and dash outside. Temps in the 60s and even 70s in the next few days, perhaps. Is this February? Calling Elwyn Taylor. Elwyn Taylor joining us by phone, climatologist and professor of ag meteorology at Iowa State University. Are you there, Elwyn?
I am, and it's good to be with you on such a pleasant day.
It is. What has been going on? I look at this weekend. I'm glad to get out in it, as I just said, but what's going on in the middle of February?
Well, if you look at the wind map, you see a delightful flow of air directly from Houston to Iowa by way of Dallas, and that flow of air, well, it makes it all the way to the Canadian border in northern Minnesota. That brings in warm air, that brings in humid air, doesn't always bring the clear sunshine that we have. Sometimes it brings storms, but always, it, this time of year, it's bringing warm air from the Gulf area. This becomes, of course, the rule once we get into April, that it's not the general rule to have this kind of airflow in February.
Mm-hmm. How would you characterize the winter we've had here in Iowa, in the Midwest, so far? I know some of the northern tier counties did get some snowfall. In the south, really only a couple minor instances.
Well, it certainly hasn't been a harsh winter for either the very low temperatures, which we occasionally have in winter, that take the frost down under the bare soil to 5 feet and deeper, We certainly didn't see that this year. A lot of times, even the top foot of soil was not frozen. But down at 2 feet, we have had frost go down that deep statewide, and there's still some frost. That's why we've got muddy roads in places. The top thawed, it rained on it, and it became muddy. The water can't get out the bottom because water won't go through frozen soil. Nevertheless, if you're not on one of the muddy roads, you're enjoying a very pleasant and, let's say, abnormally warm February.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a miracle if it can break the record for warmest February for Iowa, but it's moving in that direction.
Okay, so let's have you comment before we have to go here on the possible impact on crops. What does this do to planting season, which is, you know, several weeks away?
Well, it doesn't do very much to planting season at this time. It gets the weeds started in a lot of places, especially if it stays warm. And so that'll be a little bit more, a little change in what people need to do to control weeds in the areas they want to plant and grow crops. Nevertheless, as far as the growing season goes, does it give a higher risk of being very wet at planting time? And we might say yes to that, especially if this southerly airflow continues. That's where most of our precipitation comes from, the Gulf of Mexico. When the wind's from there, it can bring the moisture.
Could we see our severe weather season move forward if this warm weather continues?
Oh, yes, indeed, we could. Because our most severe weather that we tend to have, not always the most severe things, but usually, is when we have the biggest temperature differences, cold temperatures that are moving our way from Canada or Minnesota, and warm temperatures coming up from the south. And the point where they clash is the area that we get the harshest weather.
Mm-hmm. Super weather for us to get outside, enjoy the sunshine and the relatively warm weather in the next few days. But would you be surprised, or how surprised would you be if we got dumped in the deep freeze now between now and, the end of March or so?
Well, it's not a surprise at all when you look at the National Weather Service 6 to 10 day outlook and 8 to 14 day, taking us 2 weeks ahead. They expect it to stay on the warm side of usual, everything east of the Wyoming-Nebraska border, and the chance of precipitation, a little bit above usual as well.
Mm-hmm. Can we say anything about the summer based on what we have and the winter we've had?
What we have learned is that the winter does not have very much direct effect on the summer. Remember the hottest summer of the past century, 1936, followed the coldest, wettest winter of the century.
Okay. I don't remember 1936, Elwin.
Well, I'm proud to say I don't either, but it's close to being remembered.
Okay, Elwin, we've run out of time. It's so good to talk with you. Elwin Taylor, climatologist and professor of ag meteorology at Iowa State University. And Elwin, we've got a treat. Emily Woodbury, our producer, has a little bit of warm weather music to go out on. I don't know what it is. She's going to surprise us both, but I want to wish you an enjoyable weekend. You're getting out this weekend, I hope.
I will indeed, and I need to enjoy some of this sun.
All right. Take care. Elwin Taylor of Iowa State University. Okay, River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moon with help from Chelsea Hoy. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Monday on this program, it's a legislative Monday, we'll be talking about distracted driving. And with lawmakers, I'll be joined by Joyce Russell. Well, let's cue up this warm weather celebratory music and... I think she said it was going to be Aretha Franklin. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us for this News Buzz edition of River to River. Have a wonderful, sunny, warm weekend.
Hello.